Okay, thank you, Wally. Thank you, Simon, for organizing such an interesting meeting. What I want to talk about is very much work in progress. And it is motivated by one of my collaborators, Jenna Bacon, getting quite desperate, having collected quite a few micro experiments now, getting desperate in understanding what's going on. And so I really quite recently turned to this. I did some work a few years ago, and I sort of revived stuff again. And so what I cannot completely give you is results today. What I want to show you is the problems and some of the tools and some, at least on some of the data, I have some results. But not on the actual problem I wanted to look into. So that's for the future. Anyway, to set the scene, I will begin by presenting you a few biological motivation, some biological background. And at some stage, I will then move on to the sort of models I envisage and I have in mind to deal with these sort of problems. And they're mostly probabilistic, graphical models. Then I will have a short dip into some technicalities, mainly to really convince you that working with graphical models is quite feasible, and the algorithms are actually quite straightforward, even though they might sound impressive, like variational Bayes and that sort of thing. And finally, I want to round off with a few results on real and simulated data. To set the scene, what we are facing is this sort of very, very simplified situation. So we have in a cell different levels where things are happening and going on. On the basic level, we have the genes. Then we have a sort of an intermediate level, the proteins and enzymes. And the relationship between them, these two levels is already quite complicated because genes are actually coding for the proteins, for the enzymes. And you heard in Janet Thornton talk yesterday, you saw some very pretty pictures of these type of things. Now, these enzymes either operate on small molecules, metabolites, and that's the emphasis I want to give today, or if they are transcription factors, they might work back on the DNA and either suppress or activate gene expression. So this is quite a complicated picture, and you see we have quite a few sort of loops back in the system. It's not from one to the next. There are quite a few experimental techniques that can probe this system, and widely used, and the one I want to focus on, is gene expression data. We heard yesterday in Sylvia's talk about how you can actually decide whether genes are overexpressed or underexpressed, and she told you a little bit about the various array techniques. I will come back to that in a second. What you can do is you probe gene activity on this intermediate level. So the gene codes for the mRNA, and the mRNA then is translated in the protein. And so you can probe gene activity on the mRNA level. And this is done by microarrays. I will be talking about, Jenna Bacon is actually using these sort of two-color slides, which means you have a control. And you have an experiment, you hybridize both on the slide. Each slide has a little DNA fragments that stem from this particular gene you're interested in. And if the DNA, if the control hybridizes stronger than your experiment, then that means the gene is expressed higher here than it is expressed here, and the other way around. Now, these data are quite interesting because what Jenna is using is a genomic DNA as a control. And that means that you take the genome of an organism, you digest it in little pieces, and you hybridize that as the control. And that means that you have roughly the same sort of concentration of RNA on each gene. So you're comparing so each gene here is represented by roughly the same amount of hybridization in absolute concentration terms. And so you get a kind of an absolute concentration readout in your experiment. That's quite unusual because normally you would use, say, a cell culture, a normal cell culture. So, and measure your experimental expression against this normal cell culture. That doesn't really, that only gives you a relative readout as compared to gene expression in the cell culture, in the normal cell culture. Now, Neil Stoker and his group have done experiments where they really tested this assumption and show that you can actually have a very nice correlation between absolute amounts of mRNA as measured by quantitative PCR and the readout you get from genomic DNA microarrays. So that's a very interesting first step towards actually finding interesting things in metabolic pathways. Now, what these expression arrays look like is pretty much that sort of thing you've seen that I guess quite often. You have either time series or just a series of experiments, and the idea is each of these lines now corresponds to a gene, down-regulated in one experiment, up-regulated in the next, and the idea is that the correlation between these genes actually indicates some functional relationship. As I told you, I want to focus on metabolic networks in particular, and here I just show you an example. This is the, glycerol lipid metabolism. KEK is one of the big repositories for these sort of metabolic networks. And just to give you an idea of what we're looking at, we're looking at 6,800 reactions, and we're looking at about 14,000 compounds. So this is quite a huge network. And what people usually do is they break it down in so-called pathways, so to make it more manageable. But this is, in a way, really an artifact. This just comes from textbook tradition, that you break up a network in this kind of fragments, which are, by and large, very involved in some lipid biosynthesis in this case. But there is no guarantee, and actually it is very unlikely, that there is not an enormous amount related to this pathway going on here and here, which we don't see when we only focus on these pathways. So ideally, we would really deal with the complete network of all possible reactions and all metabolites. What you see when you look a little bit closer here, what you see in all these little boxes are EC numbers. It says 2.3.1.51. And I think this is really one of the examples where people with foresight have in the, I don't know exactly when, in the 80s, I presume, or even earlier, set up a system where you can classify systematically all biochemical reactions. Not really all. I mean, there are some reactions which are hard to classify, but at least a majority, the greater majority of reactions, actually is really classified in a sort of hierarchical fashion, and it looks like this. So you have a few major headings, for example, oxidoreductases, and then you have a subheading. And a further subheading depending on donor and acceptor, and finally you end up with what are called the heterogenes. And that goes on like this. So this is quite nice. This is a good starting point, as Janet pointed out yesterday. Bioinformatics people love that because you really have a clear number for a function. Function is not something vague here. Function is something very precise. It is a particular point in the network, or so it seems, as I will show you soon. Now, the trouble is that we have, on the other hand, when we look into the results of a microexperiment, what I really get from collaborators is just a list of RV numbers. So this is the name for a gene. That is associated to a spot in the microarray. That's something I have to work with. And there is unfortunately no connection, or at least no obvious connection. When you start, there's no obvious connection between this one and this one here. So one of the problems is how to map these. And some of them are mapped, but many of them are not. And mostly those you're really interested in, for example, specialized question or more specialized questions on lipid biosynthesis, which is of interest here, there's very little known of how to map them. Anyway, what is the potential connection between gene expression and metabolic pathways? Can we learn anything from gene expression about metabolic pathways or the other way around? Can we combine these two? And one of the nicest results I have seen is stems from Yuria Long's lab, and shows very, very nicely that at least in prokaryotes you have a very clear connection and very clearly defined connection between microarray gene expression and metabolic pathways. This is just an arginine biosynthetic pathway. And what you see here is a time scale. So it starts at zero, and this is in minutes, goes up to 100, so 1.5 hours roughly. And what you see is that, so what they did, they took a E. coli and put it in a medium that was depleted of arginine. So E. coli was then forced to produce arginine specifically. It had all the other amino acids. It was just arginine was missing. So what it did, it immediately switched on the amino acid path, the arginine pathway, which is was shut down, indicated by blue here. It switched it on in a sort of very systematic fashion. So first the upper ones, and they called it, that's the title of the paper, just-in-time gene expression. So just-in-time, all the necessary enzymes are switched on. And you see this nice chain. And you see on the time scale that we really think talking about minutes, hours here. So within a few hours, you probably have this phenomenon. So if you wait for an hour, roughly, all the necessary genes are switched on, and obviously they stay switched on. So that's a good sign. In a way, this is really proof that in principle you could single out active pathways just by looking at into gene expression. The next ingredient we want to look into. So these are the sort of information we have and we want to collect. Gene expression, metabolic pathway network. The next one, which is quite important for prokaryotes, is the operon structure or transcription unit structure. Genes are organized, first of all, in so-called directons. A directon just means this gene is read off in this direction and all the others are read in this direction until you hit a gene that's, again, read off in the other direction. So that's called a directon for obvious reasons. But within a directon, you often have subunits. And this, quite often you have a transcription factor over here, and I should maybe go back then to a slide I jumped over at first. Transcription factors are important because they bind to the upstream regions of a gene, and then can either activate or suppress the expression of the gene downstream. And they're characterized by these sort of motifs, and this is another important information we might be able to use. Coming back then to the operon structure, we have such a binding site up here, and we have, say, a termination signal which forms, say, a form of loop that actually prevents the polymerase to go through with transcription at this stage. And between these two, the polymerase is actually transcribing the gene the genes in a row, so you have several genes transcribed together. And that is an important mechanism for gene regulation. And actually, most of these here are actually in a common operon, and that's the reason why they get transcribed together. So the operon structure is very important when we want to learn more about regulation of metabolic networks. There's a bit of a discussion whether you have subunits within operons. So sometimes you find that operons are split up in transcription units, which are even smaller, which always are co-transcribed. So you might have some additional signals in here that sometimes are read over, sometimes are sort of ignored, taken seriously. So the organism we are mostly interested in is Mycobacterium tuberculosis, and unlike the popular organisms like E. coli or Bacillus subtilis, so there's relatively little known about it, actually. And the reason is quite simple. It is highly infectious. Just inhaling a few cells can infect you. It is very slow growing. Doubling time is about 20 hours, so usually a microarray experiment takes about a month to go through instead of, say, a few hours or so in the case of E. coli. yeah, so the doubling time is 20 hours compared to E. coli about 30 minutes or so. It is a very interesting organism. It grows in within macrophages, so the immune system actually responds to it, ingests the Mycobacterium tuberculosis bacterium, but instead of destroying it, being able to destroy it, Mycobacterium manipulates the host cell, and it lives quite happily and can even reproduce within the macrophage. The primary infection is quite often contained, so the immune system can deal with it, and then it stays there in a sort of latent, dormant state for decades. And probably one third of you actually carry this kind of latent form of MTB. So you might feel motivated to listen to this. It has a very interesting lipid metabolism. That has to do with the fact that it has a very complex cell wall. A very hard cell wall. It's actually not easy to crush the cells when you want to get out the microRNA. The mRNA. It has also the ability to live from lipids within these sort of confined environments where there's not much sugar around. And it has about 3,900 genes. 1,200 assigned an enzyme function within KEK, which is, I would probably sort of half of them are okay, the other half is sort of a bit wobbly. And a few dozens only are really experimentally verified. So there are only very few of these gene functions are, mostly are inferred by bioinformatics means, and only a few dozens is inferred, is really experimentally inferred. So what can we do in this dire situation where we only have a few dozens really confirmed? Or how is it done? How can you assign more function to it by bioinformatics means? Well, there's a sort of a fairly straightforward approach. What you do, so you have a genome. When you sequence the genome, there's not much known about it. You only have pretty much the sequence. So what you have to do to assign some enzyme function to it is you go into one of the big enzyme databases, for example, one called the name Enzyme. It provides you with profiles with proteins which are all related to a particular EC function, so you can extract these proteins. You create a profile from them, and I'm particularly referring to one tool, Shark Hunt, in the group of David Westhead from Leeds, developed there. They use muscle. This is this alignment algorithm, so they align all the protein sequences. They create HMMs and they search using WISE2 for matching sequences in the genome. So it's fairly straightforward, actually, and it results in a surprisingly high number of about 1,900 tentative EC number assignments for M. tuberculosis. And they partly deviate from the 1,200 KEK assignments, so there's already a bit of disagreement here. So that sounds great and gives hope. Unfortunately, your job is not done at this stage, because when you look more closely, what you find is quite a large number of ambiguities. For example, when you look for gene RV3842C, which is one of those induced under iron limitation and probably involved in lipid metabolism, what you see is you come up with one EC number, actually a few more EC numbers, but one of them is 31446. And when you look into KEK, you find that it is used here, and it is used down here as well. So there are two positions where this gene could actually really play a role. Maybe in two, maybe just in one. We don't know. It gets worse. There are more EC numbers associated with this gene, all with very, very high E values from Shark Hunt. So you probably can't completely ignore them. Completely different. This one is galactose metabolism. And this one is related a little bit further down the line, another sort of role for this, potential role for this gene. And, and the reverse. So we have one gene, actually you find potential roles in all over the place in the metabolic network. And the other way around, when you think, okay, so I want to focus on this one, 3146, which potential genes are there that could code for this function, for this enzyme? You find three of them, which are potential candidates actually to fit into these sort of five or six places. So you have five or six places in the metabolic network. You have kind of four or so genes, and it is unclear how they really match up. You have, it can get even worse here, you have a function 3113 where you have no less than 15 genes mapped to it. So this is cause quite some confusion. And that's exactly the situation we are in. So we have,
when you say genes mapped to an enzyme,
you mean the sequence, the RV code, as we get it in, so each open reading frame in in the MTB genome is designed by designated by an RV number. So we want to map this sequence in the genome to an enzyme in the metabolic network. Yeah, that's the question. And although we have some help from bioinformatics, there are still quite a few ambiguities. And the question is how to resolve these ambiguities. So, yeah, to summarize, we have some information, we have gene expression, we have the metabolic pathways. The metabolic pathways themselves are probably quite precise because we are really talking about chemical reactions. And although there are, again, when you look into databases like Brenda, so there are quite a few fringe sort of reactions that can cause concern and are not easy to classify and to deal with. I would say 95% or so of reactions are fairly clear-cut. The mechanism is clear. You know which reactions you link to which enzymes and the other way around. We have an organization in operons, and this is a bit tentative. We have to use this, we have to model that somehow, and we have transcription factor binding sites. This is really very tentative. Again, there's not, just to mention that, there's not much known about transcription factor binding sites in MTB as opposed to E. coli. E. coli has, is much, much better analyzed in this respect. So what we want to know are questions like the mapping of the genes to the enzymes. The gene is something in the genome, and we want to know, is this particular sequence coding for a particular EC number or enzyme? More important, or at least as important, is the question, when you put your organism under a particular experiment, in a particular stress, what kind of metabolic pathways are coming up? Which ones are switched on? And we can phrase that as which connected components, if we generalize the concept of a pathway to connected components in the network, which connected components are actually upregulated in a particular or downregulated in a particular situation. And of course, which genes are co-regulated by common transcription factors or because they are in a common operon. So what we would like to have is a probabilistic model that actually takes all this information together, and you can use information on one end to actually inform the other end. And that's our aim. Now, one way to do that is by graphical models. And I just want to talk you through the few options we have there. And one example is to take a Markov network, which is where we have the nodes representing genes or enzymes. And that is really suggested just by the shape of the metabolic network. So we link one enzyme to the next if they have a common compound, a common metabolite they're operating on. There are some issues whether you want to connect some, suppose here two enzymes which feed into two reactions which feed into a third jointly. Do you want to connect these two reactions or not? So that is a bit of things you need to clarify when you really want to go down to the details. But essentially, let's assume for the time being it's just a network. And we have two choices here, really. We can either look into discrete networks, or we can look into continuous networks. Both have their advantages and disadvantages, and I will discuss that a bit later. Now, we come a little bit to the more sort of technical bits, but this is all well known. I'm just suggesting a few extensions here, and I want to show you a few algorithms how to deal with estimation problems in this setting. So, the trouble with Markov networks is that it is quite hard to even calculate the probability of a particular configuration. Maybe I jump to the example here straight away. Oops. So, at least under the sort of most common definition of probability on Markov networks you find in the literature. So, what we want to have is we focus on two labels to make it really simple. We focus on discrete network, two labels. And so we have 0, 1. So we put a 1 here and a 0 here. And we want to know how likely is this kind of configuration. First of all, and we can really ask two questions, we want to train parameters to make this the most likely network, maximum likelihood estimation. Or we might want to ask the opposite. Once we have given some parameters for the network, we want to ask what is the probability for a particular configuration. But it doesn't matter. We don't get around the problem of calculating the probability given some parameters. And the way this is usually done is the following. So we have two parameters, two which are only associated with each node, and then we have four values which are associated with each edge. And to make it simple, we just assume we have one parameter here and one parameter for all the nodes, or two parameters for all the nodes, and four parameters for all the edges. You can make that individually for each edge, of course, and we'll discuss that in a little bit later. So suppose, and let's forget the values for the nodes. It's really not that important. So let's focus on this part. So the probability of a particular configuration is just you evaluate all these parameters, you take an exponential of them. And the trouble is that when you do that, there's no guarantee that you really have a probability distribution, so it doesn't necessarily sum up to one. So what you have to do, you have to divide by the so-called partition function, which normalizes the whole thing. And that's really the trouble, because when you look into the small print here, you see there's an X, and it's the sum of all the X's, and X is just a shortcut for all possible vectors of zeros and ones which you assign to your nodes. And so what you have to do is actually you have to sum over all possible configurations, and that means even in this small case here, so we have, it's not too bad for this one, just six nodes, so that's about 64, yeah. So that's not too bad here, but you can imagine as it grows exponentially. So we need to deal with that problem. So even calculating just the most simple thing, just calculating the likelihood is already a problem here. And so you would think that's really a non-starter, and we'll think about a few alternatives in this sense. Anyway, let's take that and see what we can do. First of all, just a little observation. You can shift all the values up and down to some degree. For example, you can shift them all by common theta zero. The reason is that this introduces an extra factor, theta zero, for each edge, and you have that then in the you can extract that from the partition function just as well as from the probability itself, and it cancels, and so that doesn't really matter. So you can always shift, if you take these parameters, you can always shift them up or down. And one thing to do, which is quite useful when you want to compare to more traditional frequencies, is actually to shift them in a way so that they sum up to one. Then you have a sort of a probability interpretation of these parameters, at least to some degree. Now let's see what happens. Well, and this is actually a situation you face in numerous other contexts as well. For example, people are quite fond of doing sort of all sorts of counting in interaction graphs for protein-protein interaction. There are huge databases. You have all sorts of protein-protein interaction. You want to get some statistics on it. And what people do is they just count how often you have an interaction, say, between two specific groups, some protease on one hand and some transferase on another, or whatever. And so you're counting how many of these interactions you have. And the trouble is, if you just count stuff by frequencies, as I have done here, you're completely ignoring the dependencies that are introduced by this network structure. Yeah. So you're just these are not independent edges; they are highly dependent. So if this one here changes from 1 to 0, your whole statistic changes dramatically. Right. So you really get invalid kind of probabilities when you treat them as independent, and that's a reason to look into into Markov networks. They have a more subtle approach to taking these dependencies into account. Well, if you then do an MLE for this Markov net, you get different results. They're sort of similar. We go from 50% probability for a 1-1 edge down to something like 0.46. We go a little bit down here. We go up here. And it's very difficult, really, to interpret these sort of shifts. Sort of explanation, most X configuration contain many 0-1s, and decreasing 0-1s reduces the Z. So it's not easy to get clean 1-1-0-0 pairs because you have this one, this connecting node in the middle. So that's a sort of a little bit of an intuitive explanation why this goes up here and why this goes down. But it's always a bit, it's always difficult to see why you get particular parameters in the Markov network, which you get. Here another example. Again, that's this, the naive frequency counting of 0-1 edges, 0-0 and 1-1 edges. So the majority is 0-1 edges here, actually. But when you do the Markov optimization, and you can do that exact here by using sort of a Markov model type of calculation, then you see that actually the most important edge is the 0-0 and 1-1 edge, and the 0-1 edge is not that important, actually. So you get these shifts quite typically in these Markov nets. So that is a bit of a warning that we really have to take this seriously if we want to do modeling of these sort of complex structures. There's an alternative, Bayesian networks, which you might remember are much, much easier to deal with. Especially you have a very simple sort of breakdown of the probability. So you, if you, as long as you stay in each family, you just condition on the parents and you get the probability of this child immediately. And you can do that in isolation for each family, and then you just multiply up all these individual probabilities. So that's fairly straightforward. And this, you might think, well, shouldn't we rather use Bayesian networks? What is the relationship between the two? It's very interesting. They are really disjoint, so they can represent different forms of independence relationships in a distribution. There is an overlap, so-called decomposable models, and that is actually quite so. Yeah. Anyway, so independence in Markov networks is represented by something which is extremely intuitive. These two nodes are independent as soon as you condition on all the nodes which separate them in the graph. So that's a fairly straightforward interpretation of the thing. You couldn't do that same thing here. So there's no way you could represent these dependency relationship with a Bayesian network. So that's one difference. and the other way around. So you have some Bayesian network dependencies which you can represent by Markov graphs. Now, is it possible to say something a little bit more about them? Is there... And yes, there is. Pearl has suggested quite early on to just represent a dependency between these nodes by a Bayesian sort of network. Yeah? So you can replace each edge by this kind of V structure. The price you have to pay to really make it equivalent is that you have to condition on this node here. And if you condition on this node, so if you condition on H, say, being 1, if you use Bayes, then you essentially get this equation here, and you again get your normalizing term down here that goes over all the configurations of X. So we are back to square one, really. So we hand, as soon as we condition your Bayes, a Bayesian network is nice, yes, but only if you kind of forward evaluate it. As soon as you condition on some of the nodes further down in the network, you're back to sort of nasty inference problems, which are then dealt with all sorts of algorithms, like junction tree algorithms. So. Anyway, so we are back to square one here, but maybe not quite. This, at least this kind of construction suggests what we might actually want to have. Because, so just another way to look at it. This is just another way to look at it. So, what it suggests is that we could actually go a step further, and then we see that we are exactly in this situation, because most of the time we don't have exact information about this connection here. For example, are these proteins really interacting or not? We only have a sort of indirect evidence for it, and that's indicated here. So we have X and Y, and we condition on the H, so that means they are interacting, really interacting. They are in the same functional class. If they are in the same functional class, they have a certain probability to interact. But the interaction, we don't really know for sure. We only have some evidence for the interaction. And the evidence comes with the true positive rate and the false positive rate. So what happens if we translate that back into a sort of Markov network perspective? Well, you just write down the equation for what is now the, if you integrate out, so to speak, H, what happens to the probability. So the probability of E is 1, X given XY is this thing here. And so reshuffle that a little bit, then we get this kind of expression. So it is the false positive rate, and it is the true positive rate on either end, and you can move in between with your probability between 0 and 1 if we interpret theta x now as the logarithm of the probability of H being 1 given the parent nodes. Yeah, so we introduce this interpretation. Then we have a completely 1-1 equivalent between Markov networks on one hand with the theta and this interpretation as conditioning on the other hand with the probability of conditioning. So this makes the link, and then we get exactly the same equations, right? So if we now plug this one in here, then we see that the conclusion is we can work in this situation. We can go back to our Markov graph, our Markov network model. The only thing we have to take into account is that now there is a restriction on the range of the thetas which we allow. So the theta has now to lie between the logarithm of false positive rate and the logarithm of the true positive rate. And remember, we can always shift things by constant, so we can shift that to where we want. But the range between these two logarithms is always given. And we have a very interesting interpretation then. Suppose the true positive rate and the false positive rate is exactly the same. So if no matter whether the genes, whether the proteins interact or not, we get exactly the same evidence. So we don't really get any evidence at all. It doesn't give us any information. That squeezes the range for all the thetas to a constant value, and that cancels out. And effectively, you have no edge. So it doesn't have any influence at all, this edge. So you can just as well remove it out of the equation. It doesn't really matter. So this quite nicely gives us an interpretation of what's going on here. This range, the wider this range is, the more the network can adapt to all the interesting things going on. So if you have a good evidence, you have a good wide range of fitting your model, your Markov network. And if this is a lousy evidence, if this is a lousy experiment about, say, protein interaction, then your range goes down very narrowly, and you can't really learn a lot with your network. It is very restricted, and the probability distribution is very flat. Can we extend that, push that a little bit further? So my idea now is to use, here we have used evidence which is 0-1. Yeah, evidence for either the protein interaction, positive evidence or negative evidence. Most often evidence really comes in degrees, so you get a value for it. For example, the evidence that two genes are co-transcribed might depend on the distance on the gene. I told you they're quite often organized in operons. And the best predictor for whether genes are organized in operons or not is the distance. If they're very close, they're probably quite likely organized in operons. If they're further apart, they're quite likely not. And what we have done here is we looked, we tried to estimate this sort of likelihood ratio by doing some sort of comparative genomic stuff and looking for syntony and that sort of thing. Anyway, it comes up with these kind of graphs where we quite like, where we can read off, so to speak, false positive and false positive rate and true positive rate just by plugging that into these curves. And we can extend the model a little bit by replacing what we had here. We had a fixed false positive rate, true positive rate and false positive rate. We replace that now by a sort of flexible true and false positive rate, which actually depends on the value of the evidence. And the whole thing goes through again. Unfortunately, now it's not easy to interpret that in a sort of a joint range of values. Now you have a slightly sort of odd transformation. So the estimation of theta becomes now a little bit trickier. But essentially, you can do similar things. You use the methods I'm going to discuss in a minute for this one, just as well. So viewing a Markov network as a sort of a Bayesian network with conditioning has allowed us to extend the Markov network a little bit and to get in uncertainty in sort of experimental information we might have about aspects of it. Now the next question is, how can we do, so we have tried to evade Markov networks. We have tried hard to get away, say, take Bayesian network or whatever. We have come back straight away. So there's no, it seems there's really, we have to, at some point, we have to tackle these kind of issues, and we might face them straight away. So originally, I thought I would like to talk you through some methods that are actually not that difficult, and but I'm afraid I'm running out of time, so we'll see. Maybe the first one, just to give you a little bit of the spirit of what's going on here. There has been very, very nice work done by Ian Murray and Zubin Ghaffarmani in this sort of double intractable distributions context, where they investigate many of these and many more of these algorithms to investigate how well parameter estimation for Markov networks is working. So one of the more popular ones is a variational method, and at least in the form of a mean field approach, it's very simple, actually. Now, this looks daunting, maybe, but I just wanted to really write it down to show you that there is no magic behind it. It's fairly, fairly simple, straightforward transformations that get you to this sort of slightly mysteriously looking equations if you're not familiar with this kind of approach. Anyway, what we want to do is we want to get an estimate of our partition function here. And we just do a little bit of trickery here. So first of all, we write it down, what it is. Remember, it was the sum of all our configurations of the exponentiation of this sort of, if you go back, this was f theta of x was just the sum of all the edges of the thetas, which we want to estimate. So that's, I abbreviate that by f theta of x. So our partition function, again, is the sum of all possible configurations of x of these, of the sum of all the edge widths, when we fit in all our possible x configurations. So it is of the shape log sum of all x of this function here, which I just abbreviated here. So this is a nice, easy trick. So we just multiply and divide by qx. Nothing dramatic about this. So here now comes a little bit, some little trick. You are always allowed to move the logarithm within the sum, so to speak, and over a factor if this factor sums up to 1. This is just Jensen's inequality. We shift the log over the sum and over the factor right to the thing behind it. And this is allowed to do that by Jensen's inequality. And there's an easy geometric interpretation why this is so. So we do that, and then we have QX the log here, and I take this QX out here. So if we rewrite that a little bit, we see that we have the form of an average of log X, so the expectation value with relation to the Q, and then we have this entropy of the Q distribution. So up to now, I haven't said much about the Q distribution. At this stage here, we just introduced the Q and canceled it again. So we are really absolutely free at this stage to introduce any Q we want. It just has to sum up to one for the Jensen inequality to be correct. So what Q shall we take? Well, we see that our log Z is always lower bounded by this Q. And so what we want to do, we want to use a Q that is on one hand easy to use, and on the other hand, which one we can sort of push up to get very, very close to the Z. And the most easiest to use is a distribution that just is independent on all the nodes. So we just have an independent Q. So the probability for xi is 1 is qi, and for 0 is 1 minus qi, and we have a qi for each node separately. So it really the easiest distribution you can think of. And now we just plug it in into our equation here. So we have to calculate the expectation of our term in the exponential, and we have to calculate the entropy. But nothing could be easier. The expectation is just we take each arc in turn and multiply its value by the corresponding probability. So the value for one, for the xi to be 1 is q1, the value for xj to be 1 is qj. The value for xi to be 0 is 1 minus q1, the value for xj to be 0 is 1 minus qj, and so on. So just very simple. And the same with the entropy. Since these are all independent variables, the entropy splits, and it's just the standard entropy. So this is the equation. We just add this to this, and ready is our sort of variational lower bound. We can now optimize this Q numerically or whatever means. You might want to get gradients, or you might sort of rephrase it a bit and make it easier. So that's very easy. The pseudo likelihood has been suggested as well. It circumvents completely calculating the Z theta, and you just assume that you can split all the axes conditioned on the neighbors. I show you a quick result that is not very convincing. And there's another way to do it, which is the so-called PV approximation, which is based on exactly the same formula I just showed you. The log partition function is expectation plus an entropy, and it's just the way how you calculate these two terms that is slightly different. So this uses belief propagation, but I don't want to go into that. So what do we have? A simple example. I showed you this 7x7 grid. On this kind of thing, you can still calculate the exact values. This is BV approximation, very, very good. Mean field approximation still okay, and the pseudo likelihood is just abysmal, right? So, but actually, pseudo likelihood is the one suggested in the biomathematics community to deal with these problems. And I think from this and further experiments, it's quite clear that it is not the way to go. Okay, so just to show you one setup, one experiment. So I tried to estimate labels of functional assignment. And you can easily do that, because one of the advantages of a Markov network is that you really now just, to find out the probability that xi has a particular value, 0, 1, you just condition on all the neighbors, and that's fine, because it shields. You don't need to look into anything, into the rest of the network. As long as you know the neighbors, you know everything there is to know about the probability of your node of interest. So I put together a few sources. This was an experiment on E. coli, and I just wanted to predict a functional relationship, and I wanted to see how much combining different sources helps. So I wanted to predict any one of these classes. So I took one class in turn and want to predict, is it in this class or is it not? So to be completely honest. It would be easier, nicer to have a complete classification, but that doesn't work, is that it? So combining sources, how can you combine sources? If you are happy to assume that the sources are independent, conditioned on the labels, you can just combine them in that way. So you kind of combine these different ways here. And that effectively amounts to just summing up all the edge weights in the exponential. And I use parameter estimation using maximum likelihood estimation and mean field. And I also get in some soft evidence. I told you before we can sort of extend that approach a little bit and get in soft evidence. So this comes from correlation between genes. So you have your sort of big false positive curve and your true positive curve. And at this point here, if you have a protein which is at this point, then you have exactly this situation where evidence is completely empty. You might just not as well use it because your parameter is constrained at this stage to just a simple zero. So, just to show that this really works. So these are rock curves. I show you some rock examples here. If you take microarray information alone to find out whether two genes are in the same functional class, you get this sort of rock curve. Nothing exciting, but sort of okay. If you use path information, diagonal information, and complex information, you get also results. But if you combine them all together, you get quite impressive overall results. So it seems for some classes, always something works better than the other, and the combination is then the solution. Finally, to come back to the question I had at the beginning, and this is really the sort of, I was hoping to get a little bit beyond that stage, but I didn't. So the plan is to do the following. Remember, what we had was this assignment problem. So we wanted to know which gene can you assign to which EC number, and there was quite some ambiguity. But the ambiguity was not completely insurmountable. I mean, there was sort of we had four variations here, four possibilities on the EC side. We had sort of five or six possibilities on the gene side. So there are sort of 30 combinations which we have to think through, a few more. But it wasn't completely hopeless. So it was a sort of finite set of combinations we had to consider. For example, here we have these candidates, and here we have these sort of candidates. So now the idea is quite simple. Just take the network, plug in a particular gene. Now you get expression levels on all these nodes. Yeah? You might want to discretize these expression levels in +1, 0, -1, and then we have a Markov network, and we just need to evaluate the likelihood of this Markov network. And if this likelihood is low, we assume that this particular bit here doesn't really fit well, so we have to look for another one. So we take the next gene. And if the likelihood is high, then we have hit our goal. So it is a little bit the inversion of the usual graph search problem. So normally you have your data, say microarray expression data, and you want to infer, say, a gene regulatory network. So you try all possible network structures, all possible graph structures on your microarray data. Here it's the opposite. You have your graph structure, you take that as a given, and you're just looking for the right data set by sort of permuting the gene expression profiles which you put in at these sort of question marks. So, being a sort of an aspiring Bayesian, I thought I would like to to use the best tool you can get at this stage. And it turns out that it is actually, this network is characterized when you move on to something continuous. If you don't want to do +/-1, that's fine. We have dealt with that in the previous slides. Now I thought maybe a continuous approach might be more appropriate here because we really have gene expression levels. And so one immediate suggestion is to use Gaussian graphical models. It's pretty much the same sort of setting. The equations look even very similar when you look into, it is just that you have continuous values instead of discrete. And such a Gaussian network is characterized by a precision matrix, or that's just the inverse of the covariance matrix, which has a very interesting property that all the zeros corresponding to all the entries corresponding to an edge are zero, right? So you have a precision matrix is full of holes. It's mostly zero when you get the precision matrix for a sort of sparse graph. And that really gives hope that one can do something along these lines. Now, sampling from this posterior is not quite so straightforward, but there has been, luckily, a couple of algorithms, and one is particularly easy to use. It's just a straightforward Git sampler. Just to leave you on a slight shock, I was really assuming a Bayesian approach is always better. So I did some simulations and just tried to differentiate. So I set up this kind of setting. So I put in some expression data, which I generated artificially from the network. So I knew exactly what the result should be. And the little shock was that the simple maximum likelihood estimate, and you get some information in Lauritsen's book about how to do that, gives excellent results on all simulated networks. You always pick the right sort of, more or less the right network. The network stays the same. You pick the right assignment of genes to network positions. On the other hand, the Bayesian evaluation was very ambiguous. It worked sort of depending on, you have to play with priors and all sorts of things. You can squeeze it, and then it operates on sort of 60-70% accuracy, but nothing like the other approach. So that was a bit of a shock. And I think I leave it at this stage then.
So in biology, there's supposed to be lots of redundancy. So, I mean, why isn't it possible that different genes are contributing?
Yeah,
the same
absolutely.
Input?
Yes, that's so. Yes, this could well be. Yeah. It's quite likely that many genes actually code for the same EC number, but it is also possible that this is just an error in the sort of still very sort of rough and tentative bioinformatics tools that do this sort of preliminary assignments. So it's a problem to really differentiate between these two situations. But it's a possibility, of course, yeah.
It's a minor technical problem. At the very beginning, you said you use genomic DNA to...
Yes.
What happens if there is some, I don't know, duplicated or pseudogene or something? You want it sort of...
Ah, yes, okay, fair enough. That's true. In this case, you have a problem. But again, these genes are known by and large, so you can correct for that.
In your last slide, where you're constraining some of the elements of the precision matrix to be zero, presumably there's a chance that you will lose positive definiteness.
No. This is part of why it's a little bit tricky to simulate from that. So how it works is you start with the Cholesky decomposition, and you kind of sort of set the diagonal elements to chi-square distributed and all the non-zero elements to sort of normal distributed, and then you recalculate all the other entries. So
sparseness is in the Cholesky factors.
Yes. Okay. Yes. So, and then you're pretty safe. Then. Yeah. Yes. So that's how it works. So that's the reason why it is not completely straightforward to just simulate any sort of matrix and symmetric matrix. Yeah. That's actually the bottleneck of it. It's not positive definite.
So have these maximum likelihood functions got unique maxima?
At least on the sort of, well, I mean, in my simulations, I give it very sort of straightforward examples, right? So there, yes, to some degree, obviously, because it was a blip of an, you know, sort of even for sort of 50 nodes or so, just which takes already a little while with the Git sampling, it was immediate. So it wasn't, and it was always the same. So
I just want to say, I thought this is really so full of interesting things that really, you know, Sarah, you deserve to be congratulated. I mean, not only have you got a new kind of problem that you, as far as I'm concerned, this is a new kind of problem where you've given the graph and you're trying to
what belongs
in each note, which I think is a fascinating new paradigm.
Yeah, it comes from, you know, I mean, this is just when people come to you and say, look, I don't know, I have this, I'll be known this, where should I put it? And this is the best source.
I mean, I can see that this is going to keep a lot of other people busy, sort of thinking about the same kind of thing. And then there's this nice idea you've got of sort of converting, if I'm sort of creating a Markov net into a Bayes net. I must admit, I slightly lost the connection of where it got you in the end, because you still ended up using variational methods.
Yeah. But it gave me constraints. It gave me constraints on the possible thickness. That's all.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So well, in your, when you use the variational methods or whatever your preferred tool is to do the optimization, you just have regions of thetas which are off limits, so you can't go there because your evidence doesn't allow you to do that.
Okay.
So so all your thetas are squeezed in a much narrower range. So if you have theta 0, 0, can't get away too far from theta 1, 1.
Okay.
That's the effect.
Okay. Because I thought that was a disadvantage, but that's the point.
That's the point. Yes. Yeah. So, you get constraints for you.
If I may make one more comment, it's always tricky. You know, the disappointing results that you got on the Gibbs sampler at the end. I think it's always tricky trying to evaluate a Bayesian method on frequentist principles. And I guess that's what you're trying to do. I mean, you might get the maximum right, but Bayesian solution is trying to do a bit more than that very often. So maybe you're a bit harsh on the Bayesian method.
Okay, right. Yeah, I hope so. I mean, I keep trying, definitely, and I'm just fascinated by Bayesian methods. I mean, they're just... But in this case, it was a bit... normally, they allow you not to think too much. It is pretty straightforward what you have to do, how you implement it. You get all sorts of information out of it. But in this case, it's just annoying. You have to fill with the priors and so on, and still don't get the performance. And so, just one case where it's the other way around. But I'll keep trying. Definitely.
Staying on time. Thank you very much. Thank you.